I said on the other side, or talked about my first experience with privilege and what it meant to be a doctor. I was a pharmacist made third class, and I had duties. I had interesting duties, and that I had my own dispensary. I had my own. I was in charge of my own operation, and every day would leave the main hospital and travel by ambulance to an outlying airfield where secret testing was going on. And there were pilots that would fly in and out of there doing these special runs, and some of the secret testing included dropping silver foil out of the sky to upset radar waves. There was also what practice torpedo runs that was going on, and also the B-25 aircraft did some of the original practicing for the run on Japan from that field, as to where they could take off, how short the takeoff could be, so that they could use this and apply it to the deck of carriers. So it was interesting from that point of view. Also interesting that I had no boss and I was my own boss, and we had our own cook, we had our own tower to control the traffic, so we had waves who ran the tower. Waves means women, military, Navy, and then I was the doctor, I was the pharmacist. So that was a nice experience, and I enjoyed that. But went about my business and didn't have any special incidents, got along quite well. However, when my orders came in, I was told to pick up my orders, and that they were orders were in for me, and I went to pick them up, and this was probably around sometime in September of 44. And when I went to pick them up, they said, the commanding officer wants to see you. The commanding officer of the hospital was a captain in the Navy who was a medical officer, a doctor. And I went in, the pharmacist made third class is here to report. And the captain came out of his office, and I saluted him. He said, oh, no, don't do that. He said, why didn't you tell me that you were going to be a doctor? He said, I would have put you right here in my office. So I realized then that life was different for people who had special preparation in life or special opportunities. Nonetheless, I made some good friends at that time, none of them Jewish, by the way. And I remember we bought a car, I think it was $60, we bought a car. The car was made in 1936. It's a Chevrolet, as I recall, and we used it to drive back and forth. Another pharmacist made mine. We used it to drive back and forth to Washington, D.C. for weekend dates. That was fun, except we'd get stuck on the highway, and fortunately, he was a mechanic. He wasn't Jewish, of course, naturally. He was a mechanic. So he would fix the car, and we'd get in and go back, and it worked out quite well. One vivid recollection I have is that I had one date who wore terrible perfume, and that car smelled of that perfume for as long as I can remember, as long as we had that car. Finally, we got rid of the car because both of us were transferred out. I was transferred to Pittsburgh to medical school, started medical school, and he was transferred to duty somewhere. But when I came back to Pittsburgh, I was able to live at home. We then lived at the Ruskin Apartments, and just my mother and me, and I started as a freshman. I didn't have any other activity at that time except studying. Studying consisted of getting up in the morning, going to school, class. Freshman year of medical school was mostly dissection of a corpse. That lasted till about noon or one. Then there were some other classes, and then home and study. study till midnight and the same thing the next day. I made one exception to that routine, is that I started to study the piano. And we lived right across, right behind us, behind our building, was the Pittsburgh Musical Institute. So I started to take piano lessons. And all through medical school, I would practice the piano 1 hour a day. That was a diversion and some value, and unfortunately, when I went into internship, I had to give that up. As medical school progressed, I became more and more secure in my ability to get through school, and gradually got involved, and I'm trying to think now how it was that I got involved, probably through my mother again. My mother was still, I think at that time, still working for the UJF. Oh, I know how it was. In 1946, let's see, I started medical school in 1944. So I was then about a junior, finishing sophomore, early junior, when the war was over and many of my friends who had been in the service came home. Yes, and now I remember how this went. In 1946, and I don't know what prompted me to do this, but I went around and collected $600 for the United Jewish Fund from six friends of mine, former fraternity brothers, who had come back from the military service in 1945 and early 46, had gone into their fathers or other businesses, and until that point had not been a part of or even thought of as part of the Jewish community. How I got involved and why I decided to do that is just an idea of mine, that these men were not only willing but able to donate money to the Jewish community. Oh yes, and because some of them had had experiences in Europe, which was a real education about the plight of the Jews. One of them was Al Moses, who was taken prisoner in the Battle of the Bulge.
The president of the American Jewish Committee?
No. Al Moses is from Pittsburgh.
Well, that's a different one.
Different Al Moses. And another was Buddy Hendel, now deceased. And another was Eddie Harris, now deceased. These are three, and I may think of the others, but I can almost recall one was Bob Burstein, who's still around. These were the people who made up the six men who donated $100 each to the United Jewish Fund. And I walked in the United Jewish Fund office and gave it to somebody, and they were all excited about it. They thought it was, well, $100 was a lot of money for the young person. At any rate, this really was the seed that began what then became known as the Young Adult Division of the United Jewish Fund. It was based on that a committee was appointed with Joe Silberstein as the chairman. He was on the board of the Federation, United Jewish Federation, and he and I organized what was called the Young Adult Division. And the first thing that we did was have a conference, which then became an annual conference, which took place at Emma Farm Camp. And at that conference, you will be surprised to hear these numbers, we had 125 young people at the first conference. And we arranged panels and guest speakers and discussions. And of course, the organizational staffing of this was through the UJF. Then it was actually the UJF and the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies. It was two organizations. And my job was the chairman of that conference at Emma Farm called the Young Adult Committee of the United Jewish Fund and Federation. And a lot came out of that. People were enthusiastic. People wanted to participate. People recognized, the young people who showed up recognized there was a need for them to be involved in the Jewish community. It could no longer be ignored. It could no longer be left to their parents, because many felt their parents were getting older. And the people who ran the fund and the federation also realized that they had to start developing laying the groundwork for a new source of energy. And so there's a lot of enthusiasm. As a matter of fact, following that, they even hired a full-time staff person to manage this division. His name was Dan Balsam, very nice man. And Dan and a group of us, and let's see, with me in this organization was Howard Mermelstein, now deceased. He also became a physician, a pediatrician, very, very popular in Pittsburgh. A fellow by the name of Bill Radoy, who was an engineer and left for Cleveland. I don't know what happened to Bill. A fellow by the name of Bill LeWinter, Al Rogal, Lester Hamburg, Stanley Hahn. It's really surprising when I think back of the number of people who were involved, Jesse Cohn, a number of the people who were involved who later became presidents of the Federation of Pittsburgh, who became the leaders of Pittsburgh. So the plan, as conceived, was sound and worked out substantially, and many of those people still active, and I see them around, and it's interesting how many of them recognize me to this day, because I was really the leader who started it and organized a lot of it, and everybody still recognizes that. I get a lot of the accolades because of that. But nonetheless, we organized the Young Adult Division, which was everybody out of college up to the age of 31. And we also organized a high school division and a college division. So this was all part of the Young Adult Division and Youth Division of the United Jewish Guild and Federation. When we organized that, the first chairman was Lester Hamburg. Lester Hamburg later became my stepbrother, but he was at that time a wealthy young man. His father was extremely active in the community, and we organized the fund drive, and we had our own board and our own committees. But not only did we raise money, and I think we raised substantial amounts for those days, somewhere in the neighborhood of $60,000, we then had another conference, which I chaired again, and that was at the end of the drive. That was the following June at Emma Farm Camp, and we decided there was much more that had to be done than just fundraising, so that we had an agreement with all the those organizations that were affiliated with the fund and federation to accept young people on their boards. We tried to make them understand you can't get people to work unless you put them on committees and boards, and they did that. And we assigned. So at any rate, we continued that annual conference at Emma Farm Camp, and I don't remember how many years, but it ran for 3 or 4 at any rate. I then got out of it. I'll discuss that. But at any rate, this was the beginning of assigning young people to all the Jewish organizations affiliated with the United Jewish Fund and Federation. And turned out to be very successful. Many of these people became active in those groups. And not only family raised money and became active in the various mature groups, but as I pointed out earlier, a certain number of them actually became the leaders of the Federation, presidents of the Federation. So it was a major contribution, this whole question of young adult division, how it started. I think that if you were to ask anybody who's been in Pittsburgh most of their life, they'll remember it and probably participated in it. Young people were very enthusiastic. We even started at that time a newspaper called The Reflector. And the newspaper would come out two or three times a year. And I remember my friend Bud Hendel was the editor of that paper. And it wasn't very long ago that I was looking at some of the pictures in the paper because my mother died and left a pile of collected photographs and newspaper items having to do with me, naturally, as mothers are wont to do. And among those, there were pictures of all the people I've mentioned as they assumed their various chairmanships in the young adult division, or youth division. Today we have, some of these people are still active. Irv Turner, for example, I remember he was head of the college drive at Pitt, and now he's one of the most active people in the physicians division, Bob Shamowitz. There's so many that I could name who have maintained their interest in having started out through that introduction. About 51, just after that, the Korean War broke out. I then went into private practice of medicine on Darlington and Murray, an office on the second floor. And I always wanted to be a general practitioner, and I started out doing general practice, and I had an office there, and I had an office in the Hill District on Kirkpatrick and Center. I don't even know if Kirkpatrick still exists. I think it might have been torn down when they built the arena. But I had an office there, and I shared that office with a physician by the name of Shep Isaacson. That was another experience. I used to make house calls in the Hill District, talking about how the world changes. I would make house calls at 2 o'clock in the morning in the Hill District with my black bag. There was a police station, I think that's police station number 4 that hasn't changed. They would call me to see prisoners at night who were in withdrawal from the drugs. I would have to medicate them to get them to stop shaking. There's such a different attitude as far as people. I remember places that I went and made house calls, back stairs, and people living, many people in one room. It was an experience that I can't possibly ever dream of reduplicating. Certainly, I would not go into the Hill District today in the daytime, let alone driving in the middle of the night alone. But I remember one incident that my car was parked, and this was during the day, my car was parked near the office. Downstairs was a drugstore. Jay Hirsch owned that drugstore. And my office with Shep Isaacson was on the second floor. Shep and I lived many years as friends after that. He's now deceased. But we laughed many times about our experiences, but at any rate, this one experience, I was in the office and I had parked downstairs, and apparently the policeman on the police officer or the patrol officer came by in his car and was in the process of putting a ticket on my car for where I was parked, which was illegal. And the entire community surrounded my car and wouldn't let the police officer put the ticket on the car. And he finally, in disgust, went away. I remember that so distinctly because we think so differently of the communities now. This was then, and the whole black community, it was long after the whites had left the Hill District. It was strictly a black community, but a different kind of black community. I did general practice there for, I guess it was about 2 years, and then the Korean War broke out. When the Korean War broke out, all those physicians who had not served in the military as a physician had to be either enlisted or was redrafted. There was a special draft act just for doctors, an act which I considered to be discriminatory, and I think every doctor did. But nonetheless, it was upheld in the Supreme Court of the United States because this was considered a national emergency. So rather than be drafted for the second time, I enlisted in the Air Force. So that's how I came from the Navy to the Air Force and became a flight surgeon, captain in flight in the United States Air Force. I was fortunate that I was not sent to Korea, but I was sent to the country I liked best in my youth, was France. While in France, was able to travel, and I was a flight surgeon, so I had the privilege of flying anywhere I wanted to go because the pilots were always very conciliatory, knowing that I had to pass on their flight exams. So we would go to Rome for lunch or Paris for lunch and then be back on duty appropriately. So it was a wonderful experience, met wonderful people, as a matter of fact, I served at that time on the committee that opened Orly Airport after World War II, because we had to provide safe passage for American military flights, and we had to have our own corridor into and out of the airport, and I remember being asked to serve on that committee. Very interesting now when I think back how primitive everything was compared to now, how much disorganized York was. I remember then that York was the land of plenty for those who had American dollars, and it was certainly a place of starvation for those who did not. However, before I sort of left out a very important, how much more time do we have on this tape?
About 5 minutes.
Well, maybe I can cover it. I don't know if I can or not, but I left out a very important facet of my life before getting involved in the young adult division. One of the motivating factors in my being so engaged in Jewish activities was the fact that when I graduated from medical school, because of my interest in Jewish affairs, I was asked to speak at the National Organization of Federation of Jewish Philanthropies in Chicago in 1948. That's the year I graduated medical school. I remember traveling to Chicago by train. We don't do that very often, by sleeping car, traveling in the accompanied by a member of our board of directors whose name was Kitty Falk. And Kitty Falk, I remember, is a wonderful woman and a very good friend of the youth movement, Young Ideas. And she got the idea that somebody like me needed to see what was going on in Europe. And through her friend, Harry Rosen, who was then, I believe, the director of the Jewish Federation in New York, they arranged for me to travel in Europe as what under the title of VIP I, which means very important person indeed, which was a title which had to be affixed in order for anybody to travel in Europe at that time. In other words, you could not travel in Europe unless you had some special dispensation. Long story about what was going on in Europe. I'm talking about 1948. Nothing much had changed from after the war. The Jews were in displaced persons camps, those who survived, rather than concentration camps. The displaced person camps oftentimes had been those camps that had been holding areas for Jews under the time of war under the Nazis. Later became places somewhat improved where the Jews were waiting for a chance to migrate, emigrate, or resume some sort of activity. But by the time I was there, I left the States I graduated from medical school in the beginning of April, and I left immediately, 1948, and I left immediately for Europe. I was there for 3 months. And during those 3 months, probably the greatest single experience a young man could ever have, I had. I was treated as royalty, being represented as the future of Jewish youth in America. And this was all arranged by Titty Falk and the National UJF office. And I had travel papers and so forth. Everywhere that an itinerary was made up for me. And everywhere I went with a chauffeur-driven car. I was entertained by and or introduced to all the leading members of the various communities of the various countries that I visited, which included France, Italy, Czechoslovakia, which is another story, Germany, what was left of it, and so on. Austria, yes, I was in Austria. I kept a diary. I haven't thought much about it or talked much about it in the years since. I did keep a diary which no one, including me, has never read or reread. Of every day, I was taken to all the children's homes, the displaced persons camps, the former concentration camps, which had by that time had not been changed, the belongings, the spectacles, everything you see in pictures was still there. I was at Theresienstadt in Dachau. At that time, that was, remember that this is April 1948. That month, just the month before, I believe it was, Jan Masaryk was pushed from the window in Prague, was murdered. They say jump, but he was murdered, we all knew that. And the Iron Curtain had descended on Europe. But there was an organization called the International Refugee Organization of the United Nations, the new organization called the United Nations. And because they had very few dollars to spend, and the only organization that had any money to spend was the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. But then spending that year about, if I remember, $100 million in Europe. That $100 million would be worth $100 billion today, because nobody in Europe had anything. Nothing. People were starving. The only currency of any value at that time was American cigarettes. The GIs were able to barter or usurp anything that they wanted. The opportunities for obtaining great treasures was unlimited. because nobody, everybody did anything they could just for food, just to stay alive. Your laundry was done for two cigarettes.